Yazid diverted Islam from the true version that was introduced by Prophet Muhammad. Being the Prophet's grandson, Imam Hussein tried to revive the true Islam by resisting against Yazid. For centuries, Imam Hussein has taught lessons of freedom to millions of people across generations through the annual commemoration ceremonies. This is the second year that mourning processions have been curtailed amid the coronavirus pandemic. But Muslims say his legacy is here to stay. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran has condemned the remarks by European Union officials on the recent attack against an Israeli-owned tanker as irresponsible. Speaking at his online weekly press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh rejected the accusations as baseless, saying blaming Iran is a scenario planned by the Israeli regime and that the comments by EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region.
Such remarks by EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region. Tehran has summoned the British and Romanian envoys in Tehran to register protest against the baseless allegations. The fact that Britain has sided with the rebellious and notorious Zionist regime shows the position of this country.
In reaction to a statement released by the G7 against Tehran, the official said the country will not remain silent in the face of the security of its commercial vessels. He further noted that the security of the Persian Gulf is Iran's red line and that the country has always tried to keep this waterway safe from insecurities created by such countries as UK.
Iran is concerned about the obvious violation that the UK did against an Iranian oil tanker in international waters in July 2019. But the security of the Persian Gulf is the red line for Iran. Tehran has done its best to protect the waterway from insecurities orchestrated by countries like the UK. We advise the British government to pay attention to its own responsibilities and duties.
Tension has been escalating in the region in recent weeks against the backdrop of a suspected drone attack last week that targeted an Israeli-managed tanker, Mercer Street, off the Omani coast. The regime in Tel Aviv and its Western allies, the UK and the US, accuse Iran of orchestrating the attack. Iran has vehemently rejected the charges as baseless and childish. Moreover, Tel Aviv said it is ready to strike Iran in retaliation for the attack. But Iran has already warned of a crushing response to any such move.
Iran describes as suspicious a number of reported security incidents in the Persian Gulf region and has warned against any effort to create a vicious atmosphere to pursue certain political goals. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Starting almost a year ago as the first viable Iranian vaccine candidate, Coviran is now a household name in Iran. After passing all the clinical trials, Coviran launched its first production line 3 months ago and now has inaugurated the second line, which will more than quadruple the output capacity to roughly 15 million doses per month.
The second facility is larger than the first production line. It went operational today and will add some 8 million doses to the current capacity, getting the overall output to between 12 and 1 million doses a month. This will cover much of our domestic demand for vaccines.
With U.S. sanctions casting their shadow on the import of vaccines into Iran, the inoculation program has been slow in the country. The Delta variant has now swept across Iran, killing at least 400 people every day. Coviran says it is speeding up its efforts to produce as many jabs as possible to stem the tide of Delta, as they claim their vaccine can terminate the new variant.
There is a test called virus neutralization test, or VNT, which studies how much a vaccine can protect the body against a virus. The Delta variant has not yet proven to be vaccine evading, but based on VNT experiments conducted on Coviran, it can neutralize the Delta variant as well.
So far, Coviran has produced and administered 7 million doses. The biotech firm says it will launch a third production facility, which will add 10 million more doses each month, boosting the overall output to 25 million. Given a monthly domestic demand of less than 15 million, Coviran says the extra doses will be exported to other countries. Coviran developers say their vaccine has so far covered 35% of the entire vaccination program in the country. They hope with the launching of the second production line here, the government will no longer need to rely on foreign jabs to inoculate its citizens.
Yusuf Jalali from Kobe One production facility in Alborz province.
Another episode in the British government's harsh immigration policy. A deportation flight planned for August 11th. On board, 19 people of Jamaican origins in this country for up to 30 years now.
The UK Home Office, responsible for immigration, has called those deportees foreign offenders, people who have come here and committed crimes and should expect to be removed.
But immigrant rights groups such as the Movement for Justice say the move is a reversal of an earlier agreement between the UK and Jamaican governments not to deport people who arrived in the UK as minors.
These are not people who should be deported. I deal very often with people who have lived in the country as children, or who have lived here for a very, very long time, or have been convicted of offences that aren't at the most serious end of the offences. So I have seen people for low-level drug dealing, not necessarily condoning it, but it is low-level drug dealing. There's all sorts of ideological and expert, you know, sort of, I suppose, societal issues why that sometimes happens to people.
Some are believed to be relatives of the Windrush generation, citizens of the British Empire who traveled to Britain between 1948 and 1973 after the government called on its colonies to send workers to help rebuild the country after World War II.
They came in the 1950s, have really gotten the short end of the stick. And remember, their ancestors have already been through slavery and colonialism and neo-colonialism and governorships and all sorts of awful systems that has always put them as second-class citizens. Then they came here and they were treated as second-class citizens. We've seen that with the Windrush scandal. And it is their children and grandchildren who are now being shackled and put on those planes. It's, you know, a further denigration of their rights.
Last year, 50 Britons of Jamaican descent were also forcibly removed. Many grew up in the UK. The hashtag Jamaica50 is still remembered.
People watching see the way that this government holds in such disrespect the contribution of West Indian, Caribbean, and black people in this country. When will black lives matter once again?
The British government claims the deportations are everything to do with public safety or protecting victims. But rights campaigners disagree. They say the move is purely racist and political, made by a failing government appealing desperately to its racist base. Saeed Fariza, London.
After the fall of four key provincial capitals in northern Afghanistan into the hands of Taliban, the militants are now planning to capture Badakhshan, one of the strategic and border provinces in the northeast of Afghanistan. Military commanders say the fall of some provincial capitals in northern Afghanistan makes the battle difficult for government troops in Badakhshan, but Afghan forces will do their best to push back Taliban attacks.
God willing, we as the commando troops promised the residents of Faizabad to protect them against the militants' attacks. We pushed back an overnight attack of the enemy on some entrances of the city. They have suffered heavy casualties and cannot launch another attack soon.
Apart from the risk of disruptive impacts of the surging conflict in Afghanistan, the number of displaced Afghans is rising day by day due to escalation of violence in their home provinces. Since most of displaced Afghans have no access to humanitarian aid, they have called on both the government and the UN to urgently address the need of tens of thousands of families who have been forced to flee their homes.
The recent rise in violence, mainly the collapse of some big cities in northern and southern Afghanistan, has badly damaged the lives of our people. All the collapsed cities are populated areas. Hundreds of thousands of people have so far been displaced while they have no shelter. The world must pay attention to Afghanistan now.
Currently, 18 out of 34 provinces of Afghanistan are the scene of fierce battles between the Taliban and Afghan troops. The Taliban militants have captured four provincial capitals in northern Afghanistan since Sunday. The Afghan president recently said the situation will change in favor of Afghan national security and defense forces in 6 months. This is while Taliban says it's not willing to approve even a ceasefire. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me, leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the West Asia region is tense after Israel has initiated air raids against Lebanon, and the Lebanese resistance Hezbollah has responded by firing a barrage of rockets back at the regime in the occupied Sheba farms. Now, the equation in the region has transitioned as Israeli aggression is immediately met by the resistance, which responds accordingly. Another significant variable this time around seems to be the unity of the resistance front against the Zionist regime. We'll be looking at all of this on the Spotlight. First of all, I'd like to start off in Beirut with Press TV's Mariam Saleh. Mariam, thanks so much for being with us. Well, fill us in on the situation, of course, even as we're talking right now. Said Hassan Nasrallah is finishing his speech, but tell us about the significance, the points, some of the points that he made about what has happened.
Yes, of course, he gave very significant points when it comes to the issue of retaliating and confronting Israel. He stressed, of course, the fact that we do have a new regional equation, which would, of course, lead to a solidarity between all of the resistance groups, but he has spoken about this extensively before. Today he focused a little bit more on exactly what happened on the Israeli shelling of areas, and this is the first time in 15 years that we have a shelling from the Air Force, from the Israeli military Air Force. And that is why he said that Hezbollah was quick to respond, quick to make sure to take things back to the deterrence equation that was sustained since the end of the 2006 war, which lasted for 33 days. As you know, now we are commemorating that event. It began in July and ended in August. So therefore, Sayyidina Nasrallah also explained why Hezbollah was quick to respond, why he has not retaliated, for example, for the martyrdom of certain fighters that were killed, whether in Syria or on the border with Lebanon during protests in solidarity with Al-Quds, the Sword of Al-Quds. He said that this is only to stress the fact and tell the Israelis that it is forbidden to launch the shelling from your air force, whether even if it is on open territory. As you know, the Israelis launched on Thursday some shelling in open territory. Therefore, as Hezbollah was quick to respond, also on open territory in the occupied Sheba farms, but he also stressed that next time it will not be only in the Sheba farms. It could even be in targets in occupied Palestine or in the occupied Golan Heights.
And I thought it was interesting, Mariam, one point that also he made was that the resistance initiated that attack during the day because they didn't want to initiate terror against civilians. The opposite, of course, of what the Israeli regime did and, of course, initiated those attacks on Lebanon in the middle of the night. Thanks so much for that update out of Beirut. That's Mariam Saleh. And now I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Another guest, author and journalist Jim Kavanaugh out of New York. And historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Halset. Thank you both for being with us. I'm going to start this off in New York with Jim. Your take, Jim, why do you think that Israel initiated this attack on Lebanon now?
I'm not sure. You know, as your correspondent said, it seems to have been an attack on an open area, which, you know, doesn't seem to have much rationale to it. The response by Hezbollah also was an open area. I think they were trying to provoke Hezbollah into a response. Hezbollah did, this is the first time in 15 years they've claimed a rocket attack against Israel, and they made very clear, we deliberately put it into an open area et cetera. And I think really what you have is Israel is dying to get into war with Lebanon, with Iran. And they're trying to provoke something, I think. So generally speaking, I think that would be, you know, their stance after the supposed missile attack or the drone attack on the ship in the Gulf was we have to go to war with Iran. And they're trying to get the Americans to go along with that. So I think they're hoping to provoke something that would be a casus belli, that they could present as a casus belli to the world.
Brett, your thoughts on that. Do you think that Israel wants to go to war on Lebanon?
Well, I think this is definitely a strong possibility. We have to bear in mind that Israel itself is coming out of years of political strife and internal struggle within the Zionist entity itself. When you read mainstream media in the West, they often like to talk about the fact that Lebanon is mired in political strife and infighting on the political level. But the same goes, of course, for the Zionist entity itself. They have had several elections in the span of just a couple of years, and eventually they had to find a form of unity government in order to get Benjamin Netanyahu out, a unity government with 8 parties that have a very fragile balance right now, which has seen Naftali Bennett come to power, but on a very fragile and very shaky ground that he is standing on. And in fact, the issues that have been plaguing the Zionist entity have been so big that in many cases during these elections, they didn't even talk about what to do with Palestine, what to do with the resistance, because they were too busy talking about the internal actual struggles that plagued people over there. So from that point of view, it is very important, I think, for a Zionist politician, especially an aggressive hawkish politician such as Naftali Bennett, to try to lure all the attention away from the internal problems and struggles of his colonial regime and instead focus the attention on a potential foreign war that he's probably hoping to bring to a swift and successful conclusion. This is playing by the book that has been going along for hundreds and hundreds of years, of course, especially in imperial politics, is whenever you have internal domestic struggle, try to find an external enemy and go to war. The United States has been doing that for nearly 300 years now, and it has at times really worked in order to save politicians' political career. And this is something that I think Naftali Bennett is trying now as well. Mm-hmm. Added to that, of course, there might be something to it that it's the 15th anniversary of the 2006 war in which Lebanon, led by Hezbollah, of course, dealt a sound defeat against the Zionist forces. And they are now, of course, celebrating this. So what better time to try to lure Lebanon into another war from the Zionist point of view than during this 15th anniversary? This might also be somewhat of a symbolic gesture on their behalf.
Okay, well, Jim, what about that, what Brett said? Because if that's the case, he talked about in basically uniting the people at home with a foreign war. But the other side of that would be Hezbollah is not an easy target, obviously. Tel Aviv saw that in 2006. And now if we fast forward 15 years later, Hezbollah has had a tremendous amount of experience now in dealing with Syria and elsewhere. Do you agree that Tel Aviv is willing to risk whatever it has to take on Hezbollah and its allies?
I think they're in a quandary about that. Yes, you're absolutely right. Hezbollah, they perceive Hezbollah as a threat now because they're afraid that Hezbollah has precision missiles, and they very well might, and they have a lot of missiles anyway, and they know they have missiles that can hit anywhere in Israel. And it's quite clear that if there's an attack on Iran or Lebanon, Hezbollah is going to launch missiles that will strike the heart of Israel. And Israel they really don't know what to do about it, because on the one hand, they're watching them get stronger, so they think, we have to do something. We have to go out and attack them. But they also know if they do, they might get hit very strongly. And that's why there was a little dance here where the Israelis themselves kind of pulled back at the end and said, okay, you know, we're going to accept this. We're not going to go any further. But what they want to do is they want to find out what the capabilities of Hezbollah are. And they want to destroy Lebanon. They want to try and get rid of Hezbollah with financial crisis and with economic siege, which is what they're doing. You know, all this business about we've got to reform Lebanon. Lebanese politics do have to be reformed. But what the Israelis and the Americans mean by that is got to get rid of Hezbollah. So they're trying on all fronts to get rid of Hezbollah, to weaken Hezbollah. but they're also, and they have been for years, trying to get the United States to agree with them to attack Iran. Now, and that's why they keep saying that. So this is really part of a strategy that's difficult for the Israelis to negotiate, because they're already at the point where they're going to be hit hard. You know, and as one Iranian commander had said at some point, you know, when missiles start raining down in Tel Aviv, you're going to see a lot of people going back to Brooklyn. And so this is something that the Israelis can't take, but they can't just sit back and they feel like we can't just sit back and watch Iran and Hezbollah get stronger, because we want to be in the position where we can do militarily whatever we want to any country in the region that we want. We can bomb Syria every day. We can blow up Iranian tankers in the Gulf, you know, but they can't do anything to us. And Hezbollah is saying to a certain extent with this, look, we're willing to attack you. We're not going to be shy about saying we sent these rockets. So Israel has to figure out what to do about that. And it's a quandary for Israel.
What about, Brett, the difference between Hezbollah 2006 and Hezbollah 2021?
There is the difference between the two is, I think, in such a way, in terms of military capabilities, that it would be the capacities of Hezbollah right now in terms of military and political strength would be almost inconceivable, I think, to an onlooker back in 2006. There have been studies done into the military power, or at least estimates into the military power of Hezbollah, that say that the Hezbollah rocket and missile capacity is on par with that of an average NATO member state, of course, not taking into consideration the military powerhouse of the United States itself. So this is Hezbollah is by itself has a military strength of a small country. They have the support of an actual country of the majority of an actual country of Lebanon, of the Lebanese people. They have support across sectarian lines, across ethnic lines, across religious differences, as a almost universally respected member and leader locally of the resistance against Zionism. So this power that Hezbollah has been showcasing, I think, and has been building up the past 15 years, is of such an extent that I think that even the Israelis themselves have massively underestimated this. Indeed, I agree with the other guest. Indeed, what has been said is they're somewhat testing the waters, and they're seeing how strong exactly Lebanon is, but I think we have seen by the fact that the Israelis they attack Lebanon, but they make sure to attack in an empty spot first to see what the reaction will be. I think they are, at the same time, they want to be hawkish, they want to be aggressive, but at the same time they are scared, because I think deep down they know that if they wanted to take on Hezbollah one-on-one again, like they tried and failed in 2006, they should have done this like 10 years ago. They shouldn't have waited this long. And because what happened in the meantime? In the meantime, of course, Shahid Qasem Soleimani happened. The resistance in Syria happened. The massive Iranian support buildup for the resistance in Lebanon and in Syria itself happened all in the past couple of years, and has massively bolstered the resistance units in Lebanon itself and across the entire region. So the Israelis are really starting to come to terms. I think the military strategists, they know deep down, of course they want to say it, but they know deep down that the prowess of on the military battlefield of Hezbollah is of such an extent nowadays that they can't expect to just go in there and fight them in the way that they were hoping to do back in the day, back in 2006. And that is why they are trying to find a new strategy. They are indeed, as has been said, they are trying to destabilize Hezbollah's power base by economically sabotaging Lebanon itself, by spreading misinformation through media and through their minions in Lebanon. But it is something that it's shaky at best. The way in which the Israelis are doing it now is at some points nearly amateuristic, because they are so uncertain on what they have to do and how they can take on Hezbollah on the battlefield.
Well, Jim, you talked about the destabilization, the attempt to destabilize Lebanon through economic means and social unrest. And, of course, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, he addressed this and basically a message to the Israelis, don't try us, even though we have many, many problems, but the defense of Lebanon is the number one priority for the resistance. I want to talk about deterrence and the importance of that. If we see from 2006 until now that the Israelis hadn't attacked, do you think the tactics used by Hezbollah will continue to protect the country or not?
Well, I think that, you know, Hezbollah, as previous guests and I have said, you know, has built up its military capacity in such a way that it feels comfortable that it can reasonably protect the country and do damage, serious damage, and win perhaps and probably a military struggle against Israel. But these economic attacks are something else that are hard to counter in the way that, because the United States controls so much of the financial institutions of the world and the financial power of the world, that you can create a financial crisis, you can create an economic crisis, you know, you can make it difficult to buy things on the international market, you can create shortages of electricity and meat, et cetera. And this is the attempt that the United States makes throughout the world in regimes it wants to change to create suffering among the people that they can blame on the regime. Now, in this case, you have the Americans and Israel trying to construct a narrative in which the problem is Hezbollah, okay? And, you know, that's going to resonate with some people in the sense that, you know, if there are people who don't care too much about the Palestinians in Lebanon, and there probably are some, you know, they're going to say, why should we be buffeted by this because the Hezbollah's there, and, you know, as a military threat to Israel. But I think that, as we've been saying, in general in the last few years, the unity of the resistance on behalf of the Palestinians has strengthened. So I don't think it's going to work. I mean, we have to be humble and aware of the fact that this is a lot of economic power the United States has, and they're using it, and it can cause disruptions and disunity. That's what they want to do. They want to divide people, and they want them to blame Hezbollah for the problems they're having.
Well, Brett, I want to look at another angle of this, because this time around there's growing solidarity among the resistance and its support for Hezbollah, from the Palestinian resistant movements to Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Iran. They have all announced their solidarity and support of Hezbollah in fighting Israel. Your thoughts on this, the significance of this change this time around?
I think this is one of the most important developments that we have seen internationally speaking, and especially for West Asia in the past decades, basically, in the 21st century so far, is the development of a multipolar world order that has been spreading, has been developing all across the world, of course, with new superpowers and regional powers rising up and claiming their national sovereignty and their right to decide their own, to take their own matters into their own hands, away from the dictates of the United States and their allies. And this is, in the Islamic world in particular, this, of course, has been materializing in the Mukawama, in the Islamic resistance that has been spreading across the Middle East, across Western Asia, and which often in the Western propaganda is called somewhat of a Shia crescent, even though it's in order to portray it as in a sectarian point, of course, in order, because that is as well, of course, is part of the propaganda mill in order to try to sow sectarian dissent and strife amongst the Muslim people. And what we have seen in the past 20 years and what has scared the Western powers and the Zionists to such a massive degree is exactly that cooperation that we have seen between the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Syrian Arab Republic, the people of Lebanon, especially in Hezbollah. We have seen in Iraq, of course, ever since the conflict against Daesh, this has come to the forefront, the Hashd al-Sha'abi, the Popular Mobilization Forces, and other movements in Iraq who have been allying with this international movement of resistance against imperialism. And now, of course, in 2014, also the people of Yemen. This is something that has shown itself to be an extremely powerful strategy. And it shows the strength of solidarity across sectarian lines, across religious divides, across ethnic divides, against this war against Western Asia that has been going on for at least the past 100 years, ever since Sykes-Picot, the agreement between Sykes and Picot and the British and the French redistribution of Western Asian land between himself. And of course, since the Balfour Declaration, in which they agreed, the Western powers agreed to basically steal Palestinian land and give it to the Zionists, this is a constant war against the people of Western Asia and against the spirit of Islam itself. That has been going on since the end of World War One, at the very least. And this is something that has been, this conflict has been waged with the West gradually, like generally winning over and over again for the most part, up until the last couple of decades, when now the West has been defeated bit by bit in small battles at first, but bit by bit, gradually but steadily, they have been losing influence. And they have been losing to a variety of countries, a variety of political movements, a variety of religious groups, but who are all united together under the banner of anti-imperialism and the defense of the national sovereignty and of their national self-determination. And this is the most important thing that that is going on there right now, and that is exactly why Iran is one of the most important blame factors in Western propaganda. Next to, of course, on a worldwide level, you have they blame things on Russia, they blame things on China, but everything related to the Middle East and to Western Asia in general, to the Arab world, will always be blamed on Iran. The war in Syria was blamed on Iran. The war in Yemen is being blamed on Iran, and the reason for that being that Iran is seen, and rightfully so, I think, as some sort of a regional power and a regional hub of resistance. They have been uniting the powers of the forces of resistance, which we have seen beautifully during the inauguration of President Ibrahim Raisi, when people from all over the Islamic world came to Tehran in order to pay their respects and in order to basically congratulate the president on his election. This is a showcase of that global unity and that regional unity and collaboration, cooperation, and solidarity that has been growing in the area for the past 20 years.
And on that note, that brings us to the end of this spotlight. I appreciate both of you being with me. Author and journalist Jim Kavanaugh out of New York and historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hasset. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for staying with us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Masked Zionist troops will still terrorize Palestinian children in the middle of the night, but new military jargon will hide the true purpose, says Jonathan Cook, journalist, in an article titled, Israeli regime's night raids on Palestinian families aren't over. The videos are all over YouTube. Masked Israeli regime troops storm a Palestinian family's home in the middle of the night. Parents dressed in nightwear are suddenly surrounded by heavily armed men. Young children are forced awake with a mix of blurry-eyed confusion and fear. They are made to answer questions posed to them in broken Arabic by these faceless armed strangers. They are lined up in one room while the Zionists take photographs of them holding their identity cards. And then, just as suddenly as they arrived, the masked men disappear into the night. There are no questions beyond identifying the people in the house. No one is arrested. There is no obvious purpose. Just a family's sense of security permanently wrecked. To most people watching these startling videos, such scenes look like an Orwellian nightmare. And sure enough, Israeli regime has given this procedure an Orwellian name, Intel Mapping. Last week, under pressure from the courts, the Israeli regime army announced that it had ended the practice of mapping, unless, and this will be a loophole easily exploited, there are exceptional circumstances. Given that the families whose homes, privacy, and dignity are invaded are not suspected of any offense, it is difficult to imagine what exceptional circumstances could ever justify these degrading and terrifying raids. In announcing its decision, the Israeli regime army said that in the digital age, there were other tools it could use to gain intelligence on Palestinians, beyond randomly invading their homes with guns in the middle of the night. A statement added that it was a humanitarian gesture aimed at mitigating the disruption of citizens' everyday life. Palestinians are subjects without rights living under a belligerent military occupation. And this is not about disruption. Palestinians aren't facing an unexpected train delay, but a form of collective punishment, and therefore a war crime. As a report by three Israeli human rights organizations published last November observed, it is highly doubtful that any instance of mapping could be considered legal under international law. Nonetheless, these home invasions are commonplace. They are integral to the Israeli regime's army policy of surveilling, controlling, and persecuting Palestinians. According to figures compiled by the United Nations, the Israeli regime army carried out around 6,400 search or arrest operations in 2017 and 2018 alone, with each operation potentially including more than one home. Research by Yesh Din, an Israeli human rights group, shows that the vast majority of such operations start between midnight and 5 a.m. In a quarter of cases, Israeli regime troops break down the door to enter. And in a third of cases, a family member is physically assaulted. Two-thirds of families have experienced these invasions more than once. Intel mapping operations have been particularly difficult for the army to justify on any kind of security grounds. That led earlier this year to unwelcome scrutiny from the Israeli regime's top court, which gave the army until August to divulge the wording of its mapping protocol. The army's cancellation of the practice means the rationale for traumatizing thousands of Palestinian families over many years will continue to be a secret. The reality is that mapping was never really about building up a more accurate picture of Palestinian society. It has many other far more sinister aims. In practical terms, it is used to train young Israeli regime troops, familiarizing them with the techniques of invading Palestinian homes and intimidating Palestinians, all in a safe environment for the troops. The army knows that Palestinian parents will be primarily concerned with protecting their children from the terrifying presence of armed intruders in what should be the family's safest space. in testimony to Breaking the Silence, an organization for whistleblowing Israeli regime troops, one troop observed, there is rarely an operational motivation for it. Often the motivation is practice, meaning we got a breaching tool for forcing open doors for the first time. No one knows how to use it, so it is decided that we break into a house now. But there are other, even darker purposes behind these random mapping raids. They are part of the gradual process by which the army acculturates its young troops into a life of committing habitual war crimes. It breaks down their sense of morality and any remnants of compassion after years of exposure in the Israeli regime's school system to anti-Palestinian racism. It turns Palestinians into nothing more than objects of suspicion and fear for the troops. Or, as one Palestinian woman told Yeshdin, the way they banged and came into the house was like entering somewhere with animals, not people. Terrorizing Palestinians, even children, quickly becomes part of the humdrum routine of military duties. But most important of all, home invasions traumatize Palestinians in ways designed to entrench the occupation and make it more permanent. They are a form of psychological warfare, a campaign of terror against both the families and the communities they live in. They reinforce the message that the Israeli regime army is everywhere, controlling the smallest details of Palestinians' lives. Several troops told Breaking the Silence that the goal was to make Palestinians feel persecuted. One noted, the bigger mission was to instill a sense of persecution in the Palestinian population. That's not my phrase. It's a phrase that actually appeared in military presentations and briefings. The troops take this guidance to heart. One said he understood the purpose of hiding his face was to be more intimidating, scarier, and then maybe you get less resistance. Mapping raids are designed to make Palestinians believe that any kind of opposition to the occupation is futile or counterproductive. Home invasions leave permanent scars, as women often describe feeling violated and losing a sense of pride in their home, while men suffer from the trauma associated with being unable to protect their wives and children. Children are left with anxiety and sleep disorders, and they struggle at school. There is a further goal to these mapping operations when Zionist settlements have been built close to the Palestinian families being targeted. Home invasions take place on a regular basis for these families, serving as a form of pressure to engage them to abandon their homes so the settlers can replace them. A 2019 UN survey of an area of Al-Khalil coveted by settlers found that, over a three-year period, 75% of Palestinian homes in the neighborhood had been mapped. One resident, whose home was raided more than 20 times, told Yeshdin researchers, "I think the entry by soldiers is just harassment to drive us out of the house." Even some former Zionist troops understand that the intelligence gathering rationales for these invasions are bogus. Several told the human rights groups that the intelligence supposedly gained from these operations was never put to later use. None could identify a database where the information was being stored. Even if the mapping raids were primarily about collecting information, the army has far more effective means to spy on and control the Palestinian population in the occupied territories of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The job of Unit 8200, one of the Israeli regime's military many intelligence gathering arms, includes listening in on Palestinian communications to find secrets that can be used to blackmail and extort Palestinians to collaborate with occupation authorities. So-called cyber unit, Israeli regime's so-called justice ministry, is tasked with spying on Palestinians' internet and social media communications. And the Zionist regime has endless other sources of intelligence on Palestinians. Collaborators, the Palestinian Population Registry that it controls, biometric identity documents, face recognition technology, questioning at checkpoints, the use of drones, and the seizure of Palestinians for interrogation. More importantly, the army knows that it can continue as before with these home invasions by using other pretexts. It will subsume mapping operations within even more violent categories of night raids, such as the search for weapons, interrogations of children, about stoning, throwing, or arrest. Sadly, the Zionist regime courts have always shown a willingness to collude with the Zionist regime army in precisely these kinds of face-saving deceptions and cynical manipulations of language. There is no reason to believe that the Israeli regime legal system will do anything in practice to ensure that home invasions, whether for mapping or any other purpose, come to an end. The record of the Zionist regime courts has been consistently dismal in protecting Palestinians from Israeli regime army abuses. Even when the courts do belatedly rule against army protocols that flagrantly violate international law, the army invariably finds ways to undercut the ruling, usually with the court's complicity. For years, the army has continued to use Palestinians as human shields, dragging out legal proceedings by recharacterizing the practice as a so-called neighbor procedure or prior warning. It is not hard to imagine that intel mapping could be given a similar linguistic makeover. And there is an additional reason to be skeptical. More than 20 years ago, the Zionist regime top court banned the torture of Palestinian detainees, yet it continued almost unabated because the court created a loophole for cases defined as ticking bombs, when interrogators supposedly faced the race against time to extract information to save lives. After the ruling, it seemed that every Palestinian seized by the army became a ticking bomb. Finally, in 2017, the court reversed its 1999 ruling when it permitted torture as long as interrogators did not cross a threshold of pain that it declined to determine in advance. The reality is that when the Zionist regime treats its occupation as permanent, then preserving the occupation's infrastructure for surveillance, control, intimidation, and humiliation becomes an absolute necessity. When the occupier additionally seeks to drive out Palestinians to replace them with its own settler population, the rot runs deeper still. Palestinian men, women, and children are reduced to nothing more than pieces to be swept off a chessboard. For that reason, home invasions, the terrorizing of families in the middle of the night by masked troops will continue, whatever euphemism is used to justify it.
English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.